Hello and welcome to a special Business Radio X production, where we feature innovative leaders and difference makers in our communities. Hello, I'm Ryan McPherson. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we introduce today's guest, please let me remind you to connect with us on social media. You can follow the network and all of our studios and see what they're up to on a regular basis on Twitter at Business Radio X. You can also connect with the network at Facebook and LinkedIn. We will publish all of our in-studio guests as well as our phone interviews here today. And it's now my distinct pleasure to welcome on the line from Savannah, Georgia, Mr. Kurt Schmidt. How are you today, Kurt?
Good morning, Ryan. I'm doing great. I hope you're doing well, too.
Fantastic. It's Friday here in the studio. Looking forward to the weekend. How are things going for you in Savannah?
Pretty busy so far this year. I think we're off to a good start. Just trying to get things moving and get back from the holidays.
Great. Will you please share with our listeners a little bit about your background and how you're helping folks today?
Okay, so I'm a corporate headhunter. I own an executive search firm called Capto Systems. We specialize primarily in supply chain in manufacturing and energy, so upper senior middle management positions. I'm also the author of Modern Job Search, Insider Knowledge and Strategies That Work. My book is available on Amazon. And basically, the book is designed to help everybody who is looking for a job, try to figure out how they can do that. You know, it's interesting. It came about because my headhunting work is so specialized, I really can't work with everybody, but I'm always getting questions from friends and so on, you know, can you help me get a job? And I really can't. I work for companies. But the things I do to market my own candidates and get them through interviews and stuff are pretty universally applicable. And so, you know, I've worked with some very large companies. And a couple of years ago, I put all this together in a book just to be able to give something to people. You know, when they asked me about, you know, can you help me? And I couldn't do anything for them. And so the book pretty much is how I work in headhunting. And like I said, I work with some very large companies, including, you know, companies you know like Trane or American Standard or Compaq or Whirlpool, Motorola, Hewlett-Packard, all kinds of companies. This, you know, what's in the book is what people need to be doing, I think, in today's world.
Worldwide organizations helping all kinds of people get the jobs they need and they want. Is this something you've always done? Did you have some time in corporate America before you decided to branch out on your own and become an entrepreneur yourself?
Well, you know, it's kind of something I've always done. I've been a headhunter for about 18 years. I started in the early 90s with a firm. It's a funny story. I was basically 24 years old when I started and had zero experience in corporate America. But I got lucky and met the owner of an executive search firm. I think he had about 10 recruiters. And his plan was to have an experiment. He wanted to hire two people right out of college and see if he could turn them into corporate headhunters. And I was one of them. And I got my start working for them here in Savannah. And after about 3.5 years or so, I had just built such a business on my own that it was just time to leave and start my own company. And so I did that then and have been an entrepreneur pretty much ever since.
Well, that's great. We love featuring entrepreneurs here on the program. It's such an interesting niche and market you're serving. So tell us some common mistakes people are making when it comes to their job search.
Well, I think the biggest thing that people don't really understand or don't really think about is how to respect the timing and where they need to be in terms of point of view. You know, a lot of people get very caught up with the idea that they need to be concerned about compensation level, they need to be concerned about their salary and really what's in it for them before or really too early in the process. You know, the most important things to do early in the process that people don't do as effectively as they should is figure out how you can best help your potential employer. You know, where can you add value? What can you do? You know, and these things are all about positioning because, you know, in an interview process, of course, everyone knows that, you know, you need to get paid for the job you do, but early in the process, the most important thing any candidate can do is to try to figure out how they can help position themselves so that later down the road, their potential employer sees them as a solution provider and becomes prepared or interested or committed to making them an offer. And then, you know, once they kind of indicate that level of interest, that's when candidates need to, you know, start thinking about, okay, what do I need to do to take care of myself? You know, what compensation should I be seeking? That kind of thing. And, you know, obviously, it's very hard as a candidate, as someone looking for a position, you know, you think about, you know, all the pressure you have to pay your mortgage and all these things. And so, you know, your own self-interests are often very front and center, especially if you're under pressure to find a new job. And so it's difficult to have the confidence in an interview to be able to put that aside and focus on the company and their needs and their goals first. and be confident in doing so, and have faith in kind of the system that, you know they have to pay you, right? And so, you know, if your confidence comes through and you can have faith that, you know, they know that, you can do a much better job of focusing on how to help them. And as a result, they will become more interested. And so it's what I call this in my book, I call this process timing, kind of understanding process timing and when the transfer of power is and when you need to be self-interested and that kind of thing. But that, I think, is one of the more important mistakes that people make in their job search and in their interview processes, is just not necessarily understanding the timing.
Yes, timing, positioning, and you also mentioned something else there, compensation. That's where it kind of comes down to, do you have the ability to communicate what your true value is and what you should get in that new position? Are there some inside information you can give potential candidates how to ask that question or go about getting the compensation they deserve?
Well, I think, you know, it's funny. I'm not a big fan of things like terms like compensation you deserve, because I think the marketplace kind of sets compensation to some degree. And I think, you know, when people go into interviews, they get asked this question. It's a difficult question to answer. And I always coach people to do exactly the same things, because often this is a trap question. You know, the question like, what would it take to get you here? Or what are your salary expectations? Or what kind of money do you need to earn? You know, these kinds of questions are dangerous. I always coach people to answer that question very directly and to say, you know, my current compensation is X, or my most recent compensation is X. You know, I'm making this much per hour, I'm making this much per year. You say that and you stop talking. Because when you are asked that question, if you give any number, it's going to be the wrong number. You know, any desired compensation number. Well, if you say, well, I'd like to be earning a salary of Y, you know, $50,000 a year or $100,000 a year, you know, there's a very good chance you're either going to be say something too high and scare the employer away and stop the process, or you're going to say something too low and leave money on the table, you know, and not get the best offer. And so the best answer always when asked that question is, I'm currently earning X, and then stop talking. And you can always follow that up by saying, you know, I'm looking to join a company where I can make a solid contribution and grow, and I believe I can really help. And then just kind of stop and then wait. You know, the best time to negotiate compensation is after you've received an offer. The best time to even talk about it is after you've received an offer. And I tell everyone I work with this. Once a company makes an offer to you, it's kind of a transfer of power. And even if they just indicate that they're going to make an offer to you, they're becoming vulnerable. You know, they've told you, hi, you're the one. You know, you're the one we want to hire. You are our first choice. That gives you decision-making power. And that's the goal of any interview process for any candidate, is to get to that point where you get to make a decision. And so you want to get to that point before you even get into this. And once you get to that point, you let them make the offer. And then you look at it, and if it's in the ballpark, you know, you can counteroffer. If it's not in the ballpark, you can tell them. I suggest that my candidates try to keep these negotiations very short and do simple things like if-then equations. You know, basically, once a company makes an offer, they've told you what they want. They want to hire you. And so if you're seriously interested and the position is real and it's something you want to do, you can counteroffer by giving them what they want. And so you say back to them, I would love to join your company. I would love to accept this position. If you can do this, if you can give me this specific counteroffer, then I will do that immediately and I'll start as soon as possible. And so you give them what they want with the disclaimer that, you know, they need to match this number. But that's when I suggest that people talk about compensation way at the end of the process. If you've done, as a candidate, as a job seeker, if you've done your job search right, you should have a sense of what the market will pay for the type of position you're looking at. You should have a sense of where you belong. And this is something I talk about, you know, with a lot of people I work with. This is the first chapter of the book. Is about value proposition and learning kind of the market landscape. You know, if you're an engineer, you know, there are other engineers out there. You can read about them. You can look at them. You can go on LinkedIn and you can find them. You can compare your own background to their own. You can go on lots of websites and find out kind of compensation histories. You can compare that to your current compensation history. There's a lot of things you can do to kind of figure out where you belong. And once you figure out where you belong, then the compensation questions, you know, it's not going to be extreme. It's not going to be like, you know, you're currently earning $40,000 a year and you're interviewing for a job that pays $150,000 a year. There's something that misses there. You know, that's not really realistic. And so, you know, if you've done the homework, you're going to find yourself in a place where the compensation questions kind of answer themselves. And so, you know, we try to eliminate surprises. I hope that answers your question somewhat.
You answered that question and many more there for our listeners there. Thank you so much for your expert insight, for sure. So where does the potential applicant have the negotiating room? If it's not with the price, do they have any other leverage anywhere else when looking for that ideal position?
Well, then, you know, you can obviously negotiate compensation and negotiate the price. It's just a matter of the timing. So to be clear on that, you know, in a lot of positions, when I work with candidates, we do negotiate. Other kind of what I call moving parts in terms of overall compensation, you know, tend to be things like vacation. There's sometimes bonus. There's sometimes sign-on bonus. Some of these things move around. Some, you know, depending on the type of company, the size of the company, and how kind of firm their policies are, some of these things are more difficult to negotiate than others. Sometimes, you know, for some of the positions I work on, the salary ranges are so tight that there's not a lot of room to negotiate salaries. But you can always say, you know, on the side, well, if you just give me $5,000 in cash or something like that, a sign-on bonus, that's something that sometimes is much easier for a company to do. And so you always, whenever you negotiate, you try to figure out, what can the company actually do? You know, you look at all these things that are moving parts, salary, vacation, you know, bonus percentage, sign-on bonus, these kinds of things. And you say, okay, well, which will be the easiest thing for them to move for me? And then what's acceptable to me? Like I said, sometimes salaries are very difficult to move, but you can go around that by just getting a cash payment up front, some kind of sign-on bonus for accepting the position. So there's different things. It really depends.
Very good. And we're talking with Kurt Schmidt. He is author and corporate head honer. His book is Modern Job Search. And you can go to find that at modernjobsearchbook.com or get in touch with him at Capto Systems, where he's finding those specialized searches and focusing on supply chain management positions and so on. And so I'd like to ask also about, you know, using the opportunity as this as a corporate headhunter, how at the end of the day are you making money? Are you getting compensated by the companies or the actual recruits themselves?
I am what they call a fee-paid executive recruiter. That means the companies pay me. And so, and that's part of the thing that's, I think, frustrating for a lot of the people that contact me is that, you know, I do a very low volume of searches. I do, in a fantastic year, I'll fill maybe 7 positions. And these tend to be fairly high level. The searches take anywhere from, you know, 8 weeks to sometimes 6 months. The companies pay me a percentage commission based on the salary that I negotiate for my candidates. And because the positions are so difficult and the projects take so long, the commissions tend to be pretty good. It's a stressful kind of thing because I only work on commission. You know, you take a lot of risk. But I've been doing this for about 18 years, and so I've become comfortable with it. And actually, you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book and where the book comes from is because I'm on commission all the time, one of my primary goals as a recruiter was to try to figure out, you know, how can I minimize risk? How can I make this job, you know, to where I can sleep at night? You know, because this is a scary job. You know, you lose a commission, you could lose your house at any given time. You know, commissions are very large and they're spaced far apart. And so I had to develop a system that would make me feel confident enough about going to work every day and putting in a good day's work. And that system is basically what led to the book. You know, a big part of it, there's a section in the book, chapter 5, actually, I call Understanding the Numbers. And this is about that the idea that, you know, you're going to work or I'm going to work 9 out of every 10 days and fail miserably. And I know this, 90% of the stuff I work on fails, right? However, the goal I'm trying to seek or the commission I'm trying to earn is large enough to the point where that 90% failure rate is worthwhile. Now, if you consider that, it sounds crazy, but if you consider, like, for example, a job seeker, you're going to put in time every day on the internet, whatever, interviewing, doing whatever you need to do to find that job, right? The vast majority of days you will fail. However, one day you will succeed and you'll get that job. And the goal or the prize for success is such that it justifies all of the days of failure, as long as you do the work every day. And so that's how I kind of get through my days. I structure my days, I create goals, and then I, you know, I chase after it every day, knowing that, you know, sooner or later I'm going to get that commission from my company. And that's probably more than what you needed, but
yeah, that's fantastic. Thank you for sharing. I'd like to ask you a little bit about the book writing process for you. You said you've been doing this for 18 years, but the book only came out recently. What was that writing on the wall, so to speak, that encouraged you to write that book? And then tell us a little bit about the writing process for you that may help other aspiring authors.
Okay. So The writing on the wall that encouraged me to write the book is just that I feel like the landscape for my work is changing somewhat, and it makes me a little nervous. I think that, you know, part of my value proposition, and this is a term I use a lot, you know, how I create or save money for my clients, kind of where I fit into the global economy. A large part of my value proposition is search, is the ability to find people. And so as technology has come along and as some of these websites, particularly LinkedIn, I love LinkedIn, LinkedIn has become so good and so useful that, you know, the difficulty in finding people, you know, certainly, you know, for some of my searches, it's still extremely difficult, but it's not that hard for anybody. Anybody can get on LinkedIn. Anybody can build a network. Anyone can go and find people if they know how to do it. And so part of my desire to write the book was to try to find some way to potentially hedge against my value proposition declining because of things like LinkedIn. It was also, you know, I started writing the book at the end of kind of the tail end of the last major recession, you know, after the housing bust. And this was like 5-6 years ago. And it took me a couple of years to write the book. And, you know, I work a full-time job during the day, you know, often, you know, more than a full-time job. And so it took a while to write the book. But part of it was, you know, during the recession, I got a lot more people contacting me looking for work. And it's kind of a double-edged sword because, you know, obviously during a recession, I have even fewer jobs to potentially offer people. And so, you know, that just kind of builds up. And one of the things that frustrates me or was difficult for me is that, you know, there's all these people I can't help. You know, and some of them, you talk to people and they really need to find a job, and you know, I can't do anything for them because my clients are only willing to pay me to do certain things. I mean, I can give some advice, I can provide some guidance, but I can't actually place them. And so, you know, I'd spend a couple hours here or there on the phone with somebody giving them all this advice, and at one point I just started writing it down. You know, I said, there's a much easier way to do this. I think what I'm doing is right. I think what I'm telling people is right. And certainly I've made a lot of money following these processes. And so I started writing it down. And after a while, I kind of accumulated enough material where it just required some order. And then I started to assemble it and created a narrative about it. The book itself is not like a handbook. It's more like a set of stories, using three people I know and, you know, a couple of friends and somebody I work with and kind of what they went through and my advice to them during their own job searches. And so it was all these things that came together. I published the book on Amazon because, well, lots of reasons. And I'm still, I hope that was the best decision. It's been a good decision so far, but, you know, I'm nobody in the world of publishing. I'm not a known writer. I may be a very good executive recruiter and corporate headhunter, but, you know, Amazon offered the fastest and easiest way for me to get my book to market and in front of people, you know, as opposed to trying to seek out an agent and get a publishing deal and all these other things where, you know, there's a lot of people doing that. It's extremely competitive. And you know, you see the books that get published, a lot of them are by people who are already known. And so I went the Amazon route. And so far, so good.
Well, very good. And folks, get that book at modernjobsearchbook.com. You can also follow him on Twitter, Mojo Search. I like that handle there for sure. And he mentioned LinkedIn, some great ways to leverage LinkedIn. Speaking of LinkedIn, and from the job search perspective, how important it is to have an updated and professional and altogether LinkedIn profile.
It's absolutely important. You know, I'll give you an example. One of my friends here in Savannah is a company owner. And very successful entrepreneur. And they do a lot of hiring and they do a lot of hiring locally. And he told me once we were talking about different things on LinkedIn, we were talking about my book and just hiring processes and so on. He said to me, I would never hire someone who does not have an up-to-date or completed profile on LinkedIn. And I said, well, you know, why? That seems kind of, I don't know, maybe some people just don't like LinkedIn. And what he said to me was that LinkedIn is not a social network as much. I mean, it is kind of, but it's a professional network. And the comment he made was that, you know, if someone's not developed a LinkedIn resource base or a LinkedIn community, you know, I'm not sure that that's going to be the kind of person who's going to know how to go out and find help when they need it. You know, I'm looking for the kind of people who, you know, can develop a community, can develop a network, know how to reach out and know how to connect when they don't have the answer. And these are the people I'm thinking about. And if they're not on LinkedIn, they're missing out. And so, you know, that was his answer. And I personally, I think it's extremely important. And LinkedIn is not the number one resource I turn to when I look for people. And more companies are saying that. And if you don't, as a job seeker, or even someone who just wants to passively be aware of what's out there, if you're not on LinkedIn, you're making a mistake. And I think, you know, their network is almost 500 million people worldwide. And pretty soon, everyone will be on LinkedIn. It is the place to be if you're looking for work, if you're, you know, looking for candidates, or if you're just looking for solutions.
Right, or looking to connect with others in industry. It's not just a job search platform. It's a way to connect professionally with like-minded individuals. Any other technology out there you can recommend to folks, an app or anything else that you're using on a regular basis to help them in their job search?
You know, it's funny. That's an interesting question, Ryan, because I'm actually anti-technology on some of these things. I think that one of the problems with job search is that there's been too much technology, you know, especially from the company side, and you hear about this, and it's frustrating to people. Most people, you know, when they look for a job, they go to job boards, they look at job postings, and they apply to jobs online. And they don't know necessarily where their resume or where their application is going. And I can tell them it's going out into space. It's going into keyword reading software that depersonalizes everyone. And so I think that, you know, that kind of technology is not useful. The technology that's useful in job search right now is technology that kind of flattens things and connects people. You know, if you imagine you're a job seeker, your customer, the end user, the person who most will value what you can do for them is the hiring manager who ultimately hires you. And so when you apply to a position, typically your application is going to go to some talent acquisition person who may be 3 or even 4 degrees away from your hiring manager customer. And so, you know, all that hiring technology, all these job boards, all these, any kind of resume software, all this stuff is useless. The most important thing that technology has allowed both job seekers and companies to accomplish in the last few years is to eliminate things that process volume and go for precision. And let me explain a little bit. I'm trying to talk to LinkedIn about this too, and I use this in my own searches. You know, I'll give you a comparison. I know recruiters who make 70 phone calls a day or send out 100 emails a day. Okay? I don't. I sit and do research for 6 hours a day and maybe call 1 or 2 people. I don't show my companies 10 candidates. I show them 1 candidate. I use precision. I value their time. Any job seeker right now has access to things like LinkedIn where they can use, you know, precision search, find people who really care about what they can do, and talk to those people. And I tell my own candidates and I tell people I work with and I tell people in the book, don't apply for jobs. It's a waste of time. You may not get a response. You'll get nothing useful. Only apply if somebody asks you to apply. But go find the hiring managers. You can find them. Talk to them. Tell them what they want to hear. Tell them that you can help them. And technology allows for us to do that. It used to be, you know, you would mail a resume or apply to an ad on a newspaper or something, or, you know, even in the early days of job boards, you know, you would just apply online. But now with LinkedIn, and LinkedIn is really the only site that can do this because it's got such a big membership base, you can just go and exactly, you know, find the specific person who would be the hiring manager that potentially hire you and talk to that person.
That's great. It's about the relationship, like you were mentioning.
Exactly, exactly. And kind of bring it back to, you know, person to person. Flatten it out, level the playing field, you know, get rid of all this automated stuff and, you know, try to create that dialogue and that relationship that's going to, you know, ultimately lead you to a position. And it may not be, and I tell people in the book, you know, don't go and email every potential hiring manager and ask them for a job because it's very self-interested, you know. And it's also, it sets up these kind of binary responses, yes or no. And you don't want a binary response. What you want to do is set up a lot of dialogues, develop contacts, ask people how they got into their position, ask them what's important to them, you know, find out about some of the challenges that some of these hiring managers that you would want to work with, what do they face? What are their problems? Because as a job seeker, your point of view should always be solution provider. You know, I want to come and help somebody. And obviously for that, I'm going to be paid. Mm-hmm. But my goal is, you know, to help somebody. And if you can just, use that whole viewpoint, get on LinkedIn, find people who care about what you can do and talk to them, it's a much better way of trying to find a job.
I also have to ask, because it's here on my notes, is there a story you may have for our listeners about like the worst thing someone can do in an interview or the worst thing you've ever heard of someone doing in an interview?
Well, I'll tell you, okay, so that's two different questions.
Yeah.
The worst thing I ever heard of someone doing in an interview, and this wasn't me, this was another recruiter told me about, and this was 25 years ago, is that they, I don't know, something happened, the candidate was in the office with the senior human resources manager, and they got into some kind of argument, and it became personal, and they literally got into a fist fight.
Oh my gosh.
Which is just ridiculous. Obviously, that person didn't get the job.
Yeah, right.
But that's the worst thing I've ever heard of happening in an interview. The area where things typically go wrong in interviews, for most people, and kind of the worst thing that I think people can do in an interview, excluding assault, is to be too self-interested and too focused on, you know, what they're interested in, or too focused selling themselves and not listening enough. And this is really common, and it's really hard not to do this because, you know, imagine you're in a job interview, Ryan, and the first thing you want to do, or the main thing you want to do, is you want to impress the interviewer, and you want to communicate all the things that you can do for them.
Mm-hmm.
You want to tell them everything. You want to sell yourself in that interview.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to do that because you want the job. You know, you want them to like you, and you want the job. And a lot of people will overdo that. And you know, it's really hard to, as an interviewee, as someone who's being interviewed, a job seeker, it's really hard to stop, ask a question, and listen. You know, and again, it all comes back to that point of view thing. If you can go into an interview and say, you know, with the whole mindset, how can I help you? What do you need to do? What do you want to do? You'll get a lot further, and you'll get them talking. I always tell my candidates when they go into interviews to really monitor and listen to who's doing the most talking in the interview and to try to balance that out.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of like a first date for sure.
What's that?
It's like a first date. You don't want to monopolize the conversation. You want to put your best foot forward, but you don't want to let the other, perhaps the hiring manager in this point, feel like they're not getting heard as well.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
So there's lots of experience. And some people may have been in jobs for 20 years, have been a seasoned corporate professional, and then finding themselves looking for a new career track, maybe a new location across the country because their spouse is moving. What are some of the common reasons people leave their existing job and look for new jobs?
Well, I think, you know, those things cover it. You know, I have a person I'm working with now, for example, her manager just left the company where she is. And they're going to move another person into that role, and she's not going to get that job. And she feels like she should. And actually, based on her background, I agree with her. And so, you know, a lot of people will look at making changes because they want to get that promotion. They want to move into that next role. They feel like maybe they could do more, or maybe they could do it the same thing in a larger company and have a larger impact. You'll find that, you know what I find is that money is not always the prime motivator. Now, you get a lot of location stuff. A lot of my people, you're very correct, you know, a lot of the people I work with, they will move from one state to another. And so I get, you know, people who want to move from a colder climate to a warmer climate. People want to move to areas that have a lower cost of living generally. Or, you know, like you said, a spouse may have a new opportunity somewhere and they've got to make a change because their spouse is moving. Or, you know, because I work manufacturing and also because I work in energy, you know, some of these industries are cyclical, and so there'll be layoffs from time to time. And sometimes people just get laid off or their jobs get cut or what have you, and they just need to find work. But these are all common motives.
Well, very good advice. So we encourage everybody to stay updated on their resume, stay updated on LinkedIn, continue to build those relationships with like-minded individuals so you never know when you find yourself in a new career search. And if necessary, how could someone get in on your Rolodex to make sure you're presenting them to those job opportunities that are right up their alley?
Well, I'll tell you, LinkedIn is the best place. I'm on LinkedIn. I think my network is open. I accept invitations from a variety of people. To be absolutely honest, though, I am not the best person to get generally everybody jobs because my volume is so low and because my projects are so specific. But LinkedIn, again, is where I am. My website, modernjobsearchbook.com, has the book on there if you're looking to learn about, you know, and how to conduct your job search strategy and so on. But my kind of identity is on LinkedIn.
Very good. So connect with him on there. He's also on Twitter at twitter.com/mojosearch, M-O-J-O search. You can connect with him there as well. Well, thank you so much, Kurt, for joining us here today on this special Business Radio X production. I have to ask you one kind of personal side note. When you're not helping people find their job, what do you like to do to take your mind off everything and just get inspired and relax and refocus?
Well, I like to mess around with my car. I love cars. I also love photography. And so I have a lot of camera equipment. I try to, you know, I actually try to combine those things. And sometimes I'll go, they have the great historic races here in Savannah, Georgia, every October. And I'll go and just try to take photos of the cars on the track and really concentrate and spend a couple of days doing that. My wife and I do some traveling when we're not working. And that helps both of us take our minds off work. We're both entrepreneurs. She's actually a copywriter. But we do traveling, things like that, and just try to, you know, get away from work sometimes when we can.
Well, thank you so much, Kurt, for joining us here today. Look forward to more great things from you, and we encourage our listeners to get out there and get that book, Modern Job Search Book. You can find it on the website at modernjobsearchbook.com. And if you're a company out there doing something interesting to generally serve your market, your profession, and reach out to us directly on the contact page at businessradiox.com. We'll see you next time here on Business Radio X.